From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American material support to moderate rebel forces in Syria has always been modest. A few days into December, even that got wiped out. Islamist rebels tore through warehouses of the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army on the Turkish border and took everything, picked them clean. Now the talk is of collapse of Syria's Western-backed moderate opposition. This hour on Point, U.S. policy and Islamists up front in Syria's civil war. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Does the U.S. have a partner left in Syria? Is American caution to blame for the rise of al-Qaeda and Islamists in the opposition? Are you glad the U.S. has held back anyway? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In September, speaking before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on the Obama administration's response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria, Secretary of State John Kerry resisted the assertion that the majority of Syrian rebels at that time were radical Islamists.
The opposition has increasingly become more defined by its moderation, more defined by the breadth of its membership, and more defined by its adherence to a democratic process and to an all-inclusive, minority-protecting constitution, which will be broad-based and secular with respect to the future of Syria.
Maybe then, certainly now, that can sound kind of like a fantasy. Warehouses up on the Syrian border, and the Turkish border, the north of Syria, wiped out early in December by the Islamic Front, apparently, who just took pickup trucks and tanks, we're told, and everything they could get their hands on. Senator John McCain now saying that moderate opposition groups are losing power and credibility, saying that extremists have filled the void, entire sections of Syria, Senator McCain saying, stretching deep to the east and into Iraq, now effectively safe havens for al-Qaeda. Here's Kerry yesterday on ABC's This Week. Martha Raddatz asking the Secretary of State about that assessment by Senator John McCain.
It's absolutely true. Al-Qaeda has greater clout there than it had before, and it's an increasing threat. And it's a threat we're going to have to confront.
And Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, last week speaking at the Pentagon, telling reporters the U.S. wouldn't abandon moderate Syrian opposition if it's still there, but stressed Syrian rebels have lots of difficult, dangerous groups.
There are many dangerous elements. We know al-Nusra, we know al-Qaeda, we know Hezbollah, extremist groups, terrorist groups are involved in this. So it's not a matter of just an easy choice between the good guys and the bad guys here.
To say the very least, we're going to try and figure out what exactly is going on in this hour. Joining me from Beirut in Lebanon is Noah Bonzi, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. He's focused on Syria. Lead author on the ICG's recent report, Anything But Politics, The State of Syria's Political Opposition, and of the 2012 report, Tentative Jihad, Syria's Fundamentalist Opposition. Doesn't look so tentative anymore. Noah Bonzi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
And with us from Washington is Leila Hilal, director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation, a Washington think tank. Leila Hilal, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Noah, can you describe what happened at these warehouses a week ago Friday? We heard all kinds of reports in the immediate aftermath. What do we know now about what was there, what material was there, who gave it, and how it disappeared?
Well, to be frank, it's still a little bit unclear exactly what happened. And there's disagreement, a couple of narratives as to whether or not the Islamic Front fighters who went in and took control of these facilities, including storage facilities housing non-lethal aid provided by the United States, such as trucks, such as body armor. The Islamic Front claims they went in to help protect this material. Others, including some affiliated with the Supreme Military Council, the Western-backed Supreme Military Council, have described it as more of a hostile takeover. But what we can all agree on is that a week ago, this material was controlled by forces allied with the United States, and now they're controlled by the Islamic Front, which is not.
So the Free Syrian Army, or under the Supreme Military Council there, General Idris and so on, had all these pickup trucks, and I mean, I'm reading here even tanks. I don't know what that means. If it's non-lethal, everything else there pretty much wiped clean. Many are now looking at this, Noah, and saying, look at where the fighting is. Look who's really got the momentum there. It's Islamists, and there's many stripes there. We'll look at those, saying the moderate Syrian opposition is the word being widely used now has collapsed, Noah. What do you make of that characterization?
Well, I think it's helpful. One, I would just mention that some of the material at this facility was not likely to have been given by the United States, also provided by other donors, including Qatar and Saudi Arabia. So not all of the material was necessarily non-lethal. In response to your question, I think it's helpful to return back to early September when the United States decided to accept a chemical deal, a deal with Russia to rid the Syrian regime of its chemical weapons instead of a military response to the use of chemical weapons in Damascus in August. That was really sort of the beginning of a deterioration within the moderate opposition in both its political and military manifestations. And, you know, effectively, to put it simply, the more moderate elements of the Syrian opposition have gambled on Western support, whether through military aid or in their hope earlier on actual military intervention. And that gamble has proven unwise.
Leila Hilal in Washington. I'm reading here from the Daily Telegraph out of London. Syria's moderate rebels are collapsing. Western policy, including hope for next year's peace talks, that is in Switzerland, in a month's time, are crumbling with them. What do you make of that assessment, Leila?
Well, I think that we have to, at some point in this discussion, step back and question what do we mean by moderate and what do we mean by Islamist and who is this new Islamic front. It's important to not use these descriptions without understanding what it means for Syria and the future of the country.
May I just lay out what I think a lot of people understand, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but the sort of broad sense we've had was that the Free Syrian Army was sprung out of the original opposition to Assad. They were looking for a secular, a multicultural state in Syria. Then you now have the Islamic Front, which wants an Islamic regime and Sharia law in Syria. And then even beyond that, you have the Al-Qaeda-backed elements that, you know, are full-on jihad and maybe kind of radical Islamist who we're seeing now who would turn, you know, people are saying, who would turn Syria into a terror base. What about that broad characterization?
I think that's generally correct. The Free Syrian Army was initially formed by defectors, people who are defecting from the regular Syrian army as it turned in a violent way on peaceful demonstrators. And then it began to proliferate and include people that were aggrieved by the regime's response, and the proliferation ended up with tens, if not hundreds, of groups of actors that were loosely affiliated under the Free Syrian Army, which is a partner to the political opposition group which the U.S. has aligned with. And that political opposition body has held out that it is searching for a secularist, inclusive, democratic state. But what the people on the ground, what the fighters were fighting for, I think, given the fragmentation, it could mean that we didn't know exactly what those fighters were aiming for. And I think that continues to be the situation today.
But now, if the armed wing of the moderate political opposition has now effectively collapsed, and what you have are fighters who want an Islamic State and fighters who represent Al-Qaeda, is this a worst-case scenario for Western hopes of something better after Assad?
Well, I think the way that the U.S. Engages in the region typically is to say we have, is in a binary fashion, that we have the good guys and the bad guys. And the fact is that since the uprisings began in the region, we don't have a clear picture of good guys and bad guys. It is a very messy situation region-wide. And if we try to enter into conflicts and help resolve them by saying we're going to back one side or the other, I think that is a risk that the U.S. Is going to continue.
But is there a problem? I mean, talking about good guys and bad guys, when one of the parties here is Al Qaeda itself. I mean, can the U.S. not look at that and say, wait a minute, maybe that's not a great idea, and it's not what Syrians were looking for when they began all this struggle.
Well, it's not necessarily what the Syrians were looking for. I would just point out that this Islamic front, that this new alliance which emerged in November, and which is the group or the front that took over the weapons depot that had U.S. supplies in it, does not include the two al-Qaeda affiliates that are operating on the ground in Syria, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham. ISIS and al-Nusra Front. So the Islamic Front is a nationalist entity. It does hold itself out as promoting an Islamist vision for the future of the country. But what that means at the end of the day, I think, is open to interpretation.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the apparent collapse of Western-backed opposition forces in Syria. And what now for the Mideast's great proxy war? Iran behind on one side, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf nations behind on the other. Forces that the U.S. had backed looking in big trouble. The U.S. and Britain now suspending non-lethal aid, which was most of the aid in the first place. Leila Hilal joins us from the New America Foundation in Washington today, director of the Middle East Task Force there. Noah Bonzi is with us from Beirut, Lebanon, and the International Crisis Group focused on Syria there. Here again yesterday on ABC's This Week, Secretary of State John Kerry saying he believes a political solution in Syria is still possible.
The moderate opposition has been united up until recently, and we believe they still can be united. We are committed to trying to bring people together, a strong representation of the opposition, together with the Assad regime representatives, and all try to work in the same direction, which is to get a political settlement out of Syria.
Noah Bonzi in Beirut, what about that goal after the events of the last week and a half? Does that look realistic? Does the peace talks scheduled to be held in Switzerland, you know, many are writing now that they look like a farce with what's happened.
Well, there are certainly a number of challenges, and not simply the divisions and radicalization within the opposition. I think that to begin with, you have the problem of a regime that is increasingly confident since, again, going back to September and that chemical weapons deal, was never particularly in a mood to compromise. Now, along with its backers in Iran, could be considered especially unlikely to compromise. The leverage that the United States has is limited because of the weakness of the moderate opposition, so-called moderate opposition, as we're discussing. I would point here that the part of the problem, however, when we're trying to understand sort of the weakness of the moderate components of the opposition has been division and poor coordination among the opposition's backers. And here, we see this continuing today. We see the United States pushing very hard towards Geneva talks currently scheduled for January 22nd. Fellow allies in support of the opposition, France and Saudi Arabia, are openly skeptical of this. You have Qatar and Saudi Arabia supporting different groups within the political opposition, as well as different groups on the ground within the armed opposition, all of which has undermined moderates within the opposition in general and has created conditions more favorable to jihadi groups on the ground. So to answer your question quickly, it's difficult to be very optimistic about the Geneva process at this stage.
Which is essentially, especially now that non-lethal aid has been suspended to the Free Syrian Army, that's about all the U.S. is holding out. Maybe the U.S. is not responsible for a solution anymore, but you got Saudis in the last few days speaking out very prominently saying, come on, United States, it turns into a big void without you. On the other hand, many Americans didn't want to go in. Mohammed is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Mohammed, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
What do you see, sir?
I see what John Kerry said. The political solution was very, very good at the beginning, but there is no way now. It's a human catastrophe right now.
A human catastrophe. What's happening? How do you read it?
Over 787,000 dead. It's not 100,000. they're being killed every day by those extremists, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which is the Islamic State of Iraq, and Sham, and Nusra Front, the Tawheed Brigade. Those are the most extremists backed by Saudi Arabia and Israel. To create a catastrophe in the area, this will be no hope. They want to destroy Syria. They don't want no democracy. They don't want no thinking. The United States knows about that from day one.
Mohammed, are you Syrian? Are you from Syria? Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Mohammed, I appreciate your call from Omaha. One more right here from Covington, Louisiana. Paul, you're on the air, Paul.
Yes, first let me say that the moderates are willing to say anything that they need to say in order to get help from the United States, including that they're interested in a democracy. Right now what we have is Al-Qaeda on one side, and we have Hezbollah fighting alongside of the Syrian government on the other side.
Yep.
As far as I'm concerned, we should stay out of it. We've got two enemies fighting each other. They're creating hatred for each other that's going to last for generations. Let them fight. Let them fight each other. Don't give them any more money. Don't give any more help. Neither side is going to be our friend when they end up winning. The longer it lasts, the longer they're fighting each other and not fighting us.
Paul, I appreciate your call. I have to hold up a candle here for the opposition early on. That did seem genuinely interested, at least to my read, in a secular democracy, some version thereof in Syria. But as our caller Mohammed says in Omaha, the chance for that may be lost now. Leila Hilal, many look at this and just see a big proxy war between Iran on the one side, supporting the Assad regime directly and through Hezbollah, and Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states on the other, who do not want to see the rise of an Al-Qaeda-related power here. Do you see proxy war? And what about Paul's recipe? Let it go. Let it burn.
There is definitely a proxy war at play in Syria. And in some ways, the Syrians are not the ones in control, but they are the outside forces. They are the backers of the Assad regime, Russia, Iran. Hezbollah's involvement is very important for the directions that the conflict is going in. And on the other side is the Gulf states, major Arab powers, and the U.S. and Britain are also engaged in a proxy battle. But I think that the caller who is saying, you know, we have two bad sides, in fact, and so let's stay out of it, links us up with what Mohammed said, which is that there is a very significant humanitarian crisis in Syria that is impacting the entire region.
Yes.
And so we need to understand that while there may not seem to be a very clear entry point or a clear partner for the U.S. as the U.S. would like to aspire to, the fact is that we have a lot of difficult options. None of them look clear or particularly easy. But the longer this goes on, the harder it becomes, the deeper the humanitarian crisis grows, the more instability we see in the region. And so postponing some kind of deeper engagement is only going to make it harder and not actually end up allowing us to step out of the game. The U.S. will be continuously asked to provide leadership, and as time goes on, they will be more and more drawn into it, I believe.
Noah, here we are just a month before talks, almost 5 weeks before talks in Switzerland. Is the U.S. really a player here? I mean, if it's has no sort of allies with boots on the ground playing a significant role, if you've got a collapse of the Free Syrian Army, whatever John Kerry says, is the U.S. a spectator at this point?
Well, the U.S. can be much more than a spectator here.
But is it?
But is it? Well, at the moment, because of the focus on a political process, the Geneva process that does not have a lot of credibility, I would say that the U.S. is not currently a major player. And the path to playing a more proactive role, I believe, begins with getting on the same page with the other key backers of the opposition. As I alluded to earlier, it is the division, sometimes competition, in the best of cases, lack of coordination among the opposition's backers that have been so that have really played, this has really played a big role in undermining the opposition. Certainly, if this political process gains credibility, the United States will be a major player within it. I also just want to quickly address the question of letting them fight it out, letting Hezbollah and the Shia militias battle with the jihadis and al-Qaeda. I would point out, too, that this is exactly what the jihadis are hoping for. I mean, as we learned at the height of the civil war in Iraq, Sunni-Shia sectarian war works to the advantage of jihadi groups. It helps, it strengthens their narrative with their target audience. In the context of a sectarian civil war, extremists in general are strengthened. So the idea that somehow the continuation of this war is going, and in particular the rising role of Hezbollah and other Shia foreign fighters in it, are somehow going to limit gains of jihadi groups or weaken them is I think is not accurate. I think quite the opposite is the case.
Noah, when you talk Iran and Saudi Arabia as proxy players, among others, that means Shia and Sunni. But Saudi Arabia doesn't want to see al-Qaeda in here. Al-Qaeda is devoted to bringing down the Saudi monarchy. So this is really a deeply fractured picture, Noah.
And that's correct. And that there's certainly common ground. Neither Saudi Arabia, nor Qatar, nor Turkey, nor certainly the United States and its Western allies wish to see a continuing rise of jihadi power in Syria. But thus far, efforts to coordinate on that front have not really been very effective. And the Islamic front is just one example. The Islamic front, the group that took over these storage facilities that we began the conversation with, it enjoys, you know, what would appear to be good relations with Qatar and Turkey, but its main component groups have tended to not enjoy support from Saudi Arabia, which favors other groups. It gets into inside baseball to some extent, but the fact of the matter is that the allies of the opposition have simply not been able to coordinate even on shared strategic priorities.
Within that opposition, that part most closely associated with the U.S. looking incredibly ineffectual right now, the Free Syrian Army's General Salim Idris here was talking with CNN from Turkey last week about the American suspension of non-lethal aid to northern rebels. And he said, well, maybe you should suspend them because it's hard to get them into the right hands. And this is the guy in charge.
It is very difficult now to pass the support to the right hands. And that's why I can understand the, freezing the support for a period of time.
There's Idris. Leila, it would appear from that the U.S. is barely engaged here. I mean, if General Idris says, fine, don't give us support because we don't know how to get it to anybody who's on the right team.
Right, but the military option is not the only one on the table. The U.S., I think, can be a significant player on the political front. What that means is that it needs to invest more of its diplomatic power and prowess to try to get consensus amongst the major proxy players in the conflict to at least get to a point of better coordination of objectives, taking of what Noah was talking about, and trying to aim more for a de-escalation of violence in the immediate term if a political settlement is not on the horizon.
But is that a fantasy that you're describing there, Leila? Because the Islamic Front, we're told, is not interested. I mean, they swiped all the pickup trucks and whatever else was in the warehouses, but the word is that they're not interested in coming to Switzerland at all. It's not clear why Iran-backed forces would come. I mean, are we going to show up with a kind of token friends of the United States or moderate forces who don't have a real presence on the ground so that it's just a charade, Leila?
Well, I don't think we yet know what the Islamic Front is going to do on the political track. They clearly made a power play, and power looks to rest with them rather than the moderate forces aligned with the U.S., yes. But what that means going forward, I think, is a question. Again, they are not the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. They may not be ones that we would feel naturally inclined to get behind. But I don't think we have to get behind anyone. The question is, how do we line up the actors to engage in a manner that addresses, that allows us to mitigate the violence that is going on, that is creating this huge humanitarian disaster. But I would also mention another thing, that the chemical weapons deal that was made,
yes,
and the rapprochement with Iran could potentially enable the U.S. to get more from the people that are backing Assad and get them to potentially engage more in a compromising manner. So it's a hard task to say that we have a diplomatic opportunity. But it's nonetheless one that where I now see some new potential.
No, Bansi, but Saudi Arabia is watching here. Everybody's kind of thrown down. They don't want to see Iran-backed Assad still in power, especially when the U.S. and Iran have been warming up. If Iran becomes more amenable, even if it does, is Saudi Arabia going to cooperate in some kind of deal that make it feel might make it feel more vulnerable, Noah?
Well, I think you've hit on sort of the central obstacle to a political resolution at this stage, is that Saudi Arabia and Iran in particular are so far apart in terms of what they would accept in terms of compromise to end this conflict. And both view it, certainly Iran views this as to some extent existential to its role in the region, and Saudi Arabia is preoccupied, to say the least, with any rise in Iranian power and influence in the region, has demonstrated that it is willing to go very far in seeking to deny what it would view as an Iranian victory in Syria if Bashar Assad were to stay. So I think that, you know, I agree with Leila that you have something of an opportunity here, and that the U.S. and Russia, since the chemical deal, have been a bit better at working together. But the U.S. and Russia are not really the issue here. I think that Iran and Saudi Arabia, so long as they are willing to back the warring sides, a political resolution will be very difficult. And on the Iranian side in particular, I see very little appetite for compromise, again, because they think they're winning.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gunfire there. Rebels seizing a government Syrian checkpoint in Daraa on the border of Jordan in the south of the country. In the north, the Free Syrian Army, U.S.-backed, Western-backed, in disarray after a raid on warehouse that just the Islamic Front ran off with a whole lot of what the U.S. had supplied there for its folks on the ground in the Syrian struggle. Many factions here. The U.S. Backed faction not doing well, and big questions about where all this goes. Leila Halal is with us from the New American Foundation, Washington think tank, director of the Middle East Task Force there. Noah Bansi with the International Crisis Group is with us today from Lebanon. Leila, Noah, lots of response online. Rolo says, Obama dithered. The extremists took advantage. The Syrians lose out. Congratulations, USA. Another country hates you. Well, I don't know. Kay says, we've helped destroy yet another mostly secular state and turn it into a factional group of warring Islamic fundamentalists. We'll see blowback from this for decades. Thomas writes to us, one wonders why it always has to be about us. It's not. Leave Syria alone, because it's not about us. And yet, we know how these things can reach out and hit all kinds of people, and they're hitting Syrians very hard right now. Kesser is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Kesser, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. I am a I'm a Muslim, and I'm a very moderate Muslim, and I think the interest of the moderate Muslims should be the policy of the U.S. government. It should be the interest of the U.S. government.
But I think that's why the United States got involved in the first place. It looked like there was a moderate opposition to Assad, the dictator.
Yes, but our president visits Cairo and makes a phenomenal speech, and billions of Muslims, line up behind him. Yet, we later on find out that our foreign policy is being dictated by the Wahhabi sheikhs from the palaces of Saudi Arabia. We need to recognize that Saudi Arabia is the cause of all the problems within the Muslim world, as well as what the West is facing when it looks at the Muslims. We need to have a congressional hearing. We need to have a hearing regarding the Saudi regime.
Kesser, what's your advice then? Are you saying better to team up with Iran? Is that a path to moderation, really?
I will take Iran anytime as compared to the Saudi regime. The fact of the matter is we do not import any oil. We are not dependent on oil anymore. We have more power to control the policies that are coming out of either Iran or Saudi Arabia. We are not dependent on oil anymore.
Yeah. Kesser, I appreciate your call. I mean, I think you'll still find plenty of oil flowing through those U.S. ports, but there is a lot more here than there used to be. I mean, Noah, is it clear the Saudi government clearly doesn't want al-Qaeda to end up on top here, but what about other Saudis, independent Saudis supporting al-Qaeda? What about the Saudi interest here and U.S. interests or just peace interests in this region, Noah?
Right, and I do think it's important to emphasize that the Saudi government is not involved in the support of the most extreme of these militant groups. They have been working, to some extent, as I mentioned, coordination hasn't been great, but they've been working to support more moderate elements, as has the United States. But the question of individual donors is another matter. And while the Saudi government has actually made efforts to rein in private fundraising within the kingdom, private fundraising on behalf of extremist groups in Syria, we have seen that in neighboring countries, notably Kuwait, restrictions are much more lax, lax to non-existent, and you have quite conservative, even extremist clerics openly raising money from private donors and delivering it to jihadi groups and other groups inside Syria. This support has, to some extent, been more efficient than that provided by Western governments, to be sure. I understand the frustration, certainly. I do think that, again, I would emphasize that, however, that there is some common interest between the United States with Saudi Arabia and other partners on behalf of the opposition in working together to rein in these extremists. I don't think it makes sense to generalize and label.
Right.
What
about our listener on Twitter who says, leave Syria alone because it's not about us?
And certainly that sentiment is extremely understandable, but I would simply say that the rise of jihadi groups in Syria presents the best opportunity for al-Qaeda and like-minded groups that they've really ever had.
Opportunity to do what?
In the short term, simply to continue to gain control of parts of Syrian society, but continue to expand their control of territory on the ground. But obviously, these groups maintain mid to long term goals of striking Western targets, of targeting what they view as apostate regimes in the region, including the Saudi government. All of the threats that we perceive, that we as Americans have perceived from al-Qaeda affiliates over the last 15 years or what have you, remain very much in play. And so insofar as the United States is concerned about jihadi groups as a threat to American interests, of course the United States has to be concerned with what goes on in Syria.
Sumner's calling from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
And thank you, Tom. I just wanted to say that we have gotten into the situation in Syria because of the ineptitude of the Obama administration. They have consistently chosen their view of idealism or of idealistic actions rather than taking any kind of pragmatic approach. They are complete neophytes, or certainly Obama is.
What would have been pragmatic here, Sumner, in your estimation? What would have been pragmatic?
By not starting at the beginning with giving arms to the people that we considered moderates. We held them to a high standard, and we have been hoisted by our own petard. We're in the process of making the same mistake in his policy in Iran and throughout the Middle East, his rejection of basically chastisement publicly of Saudi Arabia, etc. In most of that area of the world, there are no Democrats, true Democrats, liberal Democrats, and there are no pure good guys. And unfortunately, the Obama administration basically has been looking for good guys in its own purest vision of things.
Sumner, let us pick it up. Leila Halal, what about the critique? There's too much idealism here, not enough pragmatism. What do you say, Leila?
Well, I think the Obama administration has been very reluctant to take ownership of the Syrian conflict. And their policy, I think, is one that has been defined by ambivalence and inconsistency, underscored by a deep reluctance, again, to get involved. And I think that we see that position is not working, because the situation is really becoming one of an immense problem for the region and, in fact, wider for the world. And I think that we have to keep focus on the role of the Assad regime. We cannot afford to get caught up too much in this question of who are the good guys on the battlefield, and lose focus on what is causing the major humanitarian disaster in the country.
But if Assad should fall and you have an al-Qaeda flag over Damascus, is that a victory?
The Syrian people don't want that flag. And that flag would not be there for very long.
Watch this space. Peace talks scheduled for Switzerland, January 22nd. We'll see where that goes. Very grateful to the two of you for joining us this hour. Leila Halal with the New America Foundation Middle East Task Force. Thank you for joining us from Washington, Leila.
Thank you.
And Noah Bonzi in Beirut with the International Crisis Group. Noah, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, we talk with Amnesty International about the Syrian refugee crisis. This is On Point. Almost 2.5 million Syrians have fled Syria into neighboring countries, where they're often housed in little more than tents as they face bitter temperatures as winter has moved in. Refugees inside Syria as well, of course, some of their own cities. The stories from refugee camps are heart-wrenching. Children without shoes in the snow, refugees freezing to death. Joining me now from Washington is Sanjiv Berry, Middle East North Africa Advocacy Director for Amnesty International. Sanjiv, thank you very much for being with us. Winter is looking tough in these camps. We picture the Middle East as always balmy, but it's not. What are the conditions being faced now, Sanjiv?
We face a variety of terrible conditions across various parts of Syria, where refugees are facing challenges from being locked into neighborhoods and communities that are caught in the crossfire of violence, to being internally displaced and scattered across the country in situations where they sometimes lack the basic amenities necessary to get through the day, up to being trapped on borders or even in refugee camps in neighboring countries.
What's the ratio now of those displaced or in trouble inside Syria versus those outside the country, Sanjiv?
Well, the latest United Nations numbers suggest that there are in total more than 6.5 million people who've been forced to leave their homes in Syria. So that's a total of nearly a third of the country's population, of which about 2.3 million Syrians are refugees outside the country, and the remaining Syrians, about 4.2 million Syrians, are internally displaced people, essentially refugees inside the country.
And describe their circumstances. We typically associate refugee status with a border crossing. But if they've been driven out of homes in Syria, what kind of conditions or circumstances are they likely to be in? What's the range?
There's a full range. There are tent cities on the Syrian side of the border with Turkey, for example. There are people who are clustered in relatives' homes. There are people who are living out in fields. There are people who are on the borders with Lebanon and Jordan. In many cases, they are able to get out of the country. In some cases, people of particular ethnic backgrounds, for example, Palestinians living in Syria, are trapped inside Syria when neighboring countries won't let them get out. So you have a full and kind of tragic range of circumstances in which Syrian refugees outside the country and internally displaced people are struggling on a day-to-day basis.
Now, are they also suffering military challenges? I mean, we're reading today about a barrel bomb dropped over Aleppo, but maybe that's people who are still in their homes in Aleppo in the north of Syria. Maybe those aren't refugees, though some people appear displaced or trapped even within cities.
Absolutely. Syrians are being caught in the crossfire. You have civilians who face the horrifying choice of whether or not to stay put and hope that a bomb doesn't land on their head, or to risk leaving a conflict area or a localized conflict neighborhood. But then who knows what that means? You're essentially running down the street with your family trying to find safety while maybe facing snipers or Syrian government soldiers firing sniper rifles. You might be dealing with hostilities or hostile treatment from opposition groups. And so these are the kinds of hour-to-hour, day-to-day, week-to-week, terrible, terrible choices that Syrian civilians are facing right now as they're caught in the midst of this, you know, armed internal conflict in Syria.
40% of Syria's population in urgent need of food and medical assistance. Report here from maybe Human Rights Watch, 290,000 people in besieged areas near Damascus cut off from food and medicine for more than 6 months. And you see the winter, the snow, the storms, big storms last week. We heard John Kerry say the world must act quickly because the situation here threatens to take a humanitarian disaster into the abyss. Now, he was laying that on the Assad regime. Is the world acting quickly? Is it acting, Sanjeev?
There are nations who are doing a lot, but overall, this is a time for disappointment and outrage when it comes to holding world leaders accountable. The European Union and European governments in particular deserve a great deal of criticism from those of us who are concerned about refugee conditions. In Europe, only some 12,000 Syrians have been resettled or accepted into host countries in Europe, and that is out of, you know, some 2.3 million Syrian refugees in total. So in Europe, you've got a situation where European leaders are talking the talk, but when it comes to letting refugees into the countries on a permanent basis, they're not actually doing that. And so just to drill in a little bit more on this, within Europe, of the 12,000 who've been accepted, 10,000 are accepted by Germany. And so that means that you're talking about between some 20-plus European countries, a total of 2,000 Syrian refugees out of 2.3 million, you know, being allowed to resettle in their countries, which is a shockingly small number.
We were reading just in the last few days about nationalist groups in Bulgaria. Now, if you picture it, this is just if you go around the Mediterranean and northwest from Syria, you come to Bulgaria, sort of your first stop in Europe on the other side of Turkey, and whatever trickle has come in there, stoking nationalist political sentiment, very, very rugged stuff right there in Bulgaria. When you talk about this scale, the volume of refugees here, is this really a matter of taking them into Europe? Is that even realistic when you've got 2 million plus? Or does it have to be about aid on the ground where they are?
I mean, the answer is all of the above. So right now, 97% of the refugees, the 2.3 million refugees, 97% of them have been accepted by the countries neighboring Syria. This is Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey. These countries have accepted 97% of the refugees, and so they have experienced a shocking increase in their own populations, you know, on the level of 10 or 20% increases in their total population because of the flood of refugees. Meanwhile, you know, some 55,000 refugees have tried to enter Europe, but only 12,000 of them have been accepted. And those refugees who try to get into Europe sometimes face terrible, terrible treatment by European security forces.
Is there a solution to this without some kind of resolution to the civil war?
No. The solution there needs to be a long-term resolution to the civil war. And there needs to be a long-term resolution that involves an end to the government bombing civilian populations, you know, which are war crimes and crimes against humanity. Opposition groups need to be held accountable. And obviously there needs to be a political settlement as well. But that doesn't mean that we leave, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees out in the bitter cold, struggling on borders, you know, drowning in boats as they try to cross the Mediterranean. They need help along the way.
So far, that's exactly what is happening. The United Nations made its first delivery of humanitarian aid by air to Syria from Iraq just on Sunday, dropping food in there. They had not had any significant assistance since May, Reuters reported. That is a very long time. Sanjeev Berry, thank you for making it vivid to us, certainly too vivid to those living through it in and around Syria now. Sanjeev with Amnesty International, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.